Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Nine areas inside an oil pipeline that runs through the Mackinac Straits are showing signs of corrosion, but company officials continue to say the pipeline is safe. We'll have an update on the condition of Enbridge's Line 5 later in the hour. But first, when Governor Rick Snyder delivered his State of the State address on January 19th, I thought for a moment, wow, he's going to turn this around. He's taking responsibility.
I am sorry, and I will fix it. No citizen of this great state should endure this kind of catastrophe. Government failed you, federal, state, and local leaders, by breaking the trust you placed in us.
Since then, we've seen one question after another casting doubts on how things are changing. The governor releases 2014 and 2015 emails as he promised, but really most of the decisions were made in 2013. We learned bottled water was sent to state employees in Flint, while state officials assured residents the water's perfectly safe to drink. The guy the governor put in charge of dealing with the Flint crisis apparently knew there might be a Flint River link to Legionnaires as long as a year ago. With us to talk about these missteps and how the Snyder administration is handling its public relations is Matt Friedman. He's co-founder of Tanner Friedman Strategic Communications. So I have to tell you, there have been so many stories I thought were one-day stories, and they end up being three-day stories simply because I think, in my opinion, the governor's office kind of mishandled them. How do you view it?
I think, first of all, the state of the state could have been a real turning point in the entire dialogue about how this is being handled. And we're at a situation now where it still feels like we're closer to the beginning of this story than we are to the end, and there's no turning point in sight. And that's a bad place to be when you work in PR. The other thing that's happened over the last couple of weeks is, for some reason, PR and communications has been viewed as yet another controversy. It's being viewed somehow as a luxury item that the governor is choosing to be upsold on.
And I wanted to ask you about that because he hired two firms. Was that a good move, a necessary move, or what do you think of it?
Absolutely necessary. If you look at that communications staff, these are experienced journalists but not experienced crisis communicators. And the answer there is to go to the outside marketplace, the way it would if the state got sued and it was some case that in-house lawyers in the attorney general's office couldn't handle on their own. They'd need to bring in a law firm. Nobody would think twice about it. But for some reason, in this case, it's viewed as some kind of an expensive extra. And that has distracted from the job that needs to be done. I think it's a legitimate question. Were these the right firms? Were they brought in at the right time? Are they doing good work? Those are all legitimate questions. But it is detracted from their effort because the whole thing is controversial.
I want to ask you what the difference is between crisis management and day-to-day public relations. How do the two differ?
They really are different because day-to-day, they're questions that need to be answered. It's a lot of factual work on behalf of a communications team. There are press releases that need to go out, announcements that need to be made. But crisis is a different mode altogether. The fundamentals are the same, but the execution is very different. And you have to understand that the audience is in tune in a different way. And communicating to that audience and meeting the audience's expectation, it's hard. And if you haven't done it before, you don't necessarily know how to do it naturally. It's only through experience.
I want to ask you, how do you think the governor's mantra of relentless positive action, those upbeat statements that are a hallmark of this administration, how is that read by the public in situations such as the Flint water contamination or the Detroit public schools financial crisis?
They're in a much different mode now, and they need to start acting like it. I will keep thinking of the photo op in Lansing where they signed the bill for the initial funding for Flint, and it's a bunch of smiling faces.
Actually, I think that was in West Michigan.
West Michigan was in Grand Rapids, at a hotel in Grand Rapids. And it should have been in Flint, number one, but the smiling faces were inappropriate. Relentless positive action got him to a point. It's time for a different mode now. That's very hard to do in politics when they create a brand around a personality. But this has to change, and the audience needs to be talked to in a different way.
Facebook posts by the governor's aides and Lieutenant Governor Calley are always very cheery, very positive. From a PR perspective, is it more important to keep up appearances like that, keep the positive image up, or to be seen doing things the way New Jersey Governor Chris Christie did after Hurricane Sandy, in the trenches, hard hat on, handing out water? Or is there some other way for politicians to behave in these situations?
This is really hard in the culture of politics because the mantra is always for people in these political environments, make your guy look good. Don't make him look bad. And that's what's repeating over and over again in the heads of communications people. Guess what? Bad stuff happened here. Very difficult things are happening. The grip and grin mentality is not going to work. The audience is not going to buy it. You have to meet the audience where they are. And so you can communicate in a straightforward way when there's information to be imparted, but it has to be with a different style because this is a much different story than they've had to deal with up until this point.
Do you volunteer things even if you know it's going to reflect badly on things that have happened in the past but aren't yet known?
I say yes. And I've been met with resistance in meetings about this with corporate clients because everybody in an inside of an organization is trained to make the organization look good. There are going to be moments where you're going to lose a battle and you're just not going to look good because of it. But you hope that in the aggregate, you're going to be portrayed as doing the right thing. And what's happening here is if it isn't just one shoe dropping, it's another shoe dropping, and more shoes keep dropping all the time, this crisis is not going to go away anytime soon. Anything they know that hasn't been reported yet, even if it's bad, get it out there. Otherwise, they can't move forward. And that's really hard to do.
That's Matt Friedman. He's a co-founder with Tanner Friedman Strategic Communications. Thanks for coming in.
Anytime.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, the Washington Post ran an opinion piece from former Michigan Treasurer Robert Klein. Now, to me, the takeaway was the problems facing Detroit and facing Flint are not a matter of unfortunate happenstance. They're the result of official policy. Robert Klein joins us now. So you start out by saying Governor Rick Snyder misused the emergency manager law in an attempt to achieve an impossible goal. What did you mean by that?
When a city has no tax base, an emergency manager is not going to be successful. I mean, we've had emergency managers in the same city several times. You know, they can maybe make a short-term difference, but then a couple years later, the city's back in the same financial mess. Most of these problems aren't due to mismanagement. There are some cases of that. But we have a system in this state that really punishes local government. First of all, MSU did a study that found that we have some of the most severe restrictions on the revenue-raising ability of local governments of any state in the nation. And we've also been, you know, cutting revenue sharing payments to local governments for the last decade and a half.
Yeah, I want to stop you right there because we talk about revenue sharing all the time, and I don't think most people know what you mean by revenue sharing. So let's explain that.
Well, we passed a law in 1998 that said local government should get 21.3% of the sales tax at the 4% rate. That money would go to local governments. They could use it for police and fire and other services. And it's really badly needed because, again, as I said, local governments, other than the property tax, which has been, you know, going downhill lately, they don't have hardly any other revenue source. The amount of money that they're getting now is $585 million less than they would be getting if we had, you know, fully funded that revenue sharing law that was passed in 1998. They've put in an untenable position. I mean, you know, Flint, the average taxable value per person in Flint is $7,785. This is their property tax base. The state average is $32,000. Detroit, I think, is around $12,000. Oakland County has $40,000 SEV per person. So we've set up our cities for failure.
Yeah, you say that no matter what Governor Snyder might have known or not known, done or not done regarding Flint and its water, this is a crisis that was decades in the making.
Right. This is a special situation. I mean, there was some indifference and incompetence involved in this particular situation. But they were, you know, looking to save money any way they could, which probably they wouldn't have had to do if we had given our cities the ability to raise their own revenues or kept revenue sharing funded at the level that it should be funded at.
You say this kind of boils down to the state's hostility toward revenue sharing, and that's because of antagonism between Detroit and the suburbs. What's at the root of that?
I'd say that's one reason. I don't know if that's the only reason. I mean, the state had some difficult budget problems in recent years, which is, you know, put them in a difficult situation and, you know, caused some of these cuts. But I think there's always been tension, you know, between Detroit and the suburbs, and a lot of people, you know, moved out of Detroit because of, you know, there have been racial reasons, you know, the riots in 67, the school district and so forth. So I think a lot of people, you know, feel that they don't want to bail out these cities. They've escaped the cities and they say, well, that's their problem. That's not my problem. I don't want to pay for it. And I think that's an attitude that, you know, a lot of people have had for quite a while.
That's going to be pretty self-defeating for the state in the long run.
It is very self-defeating. And I think this administration doesn't really understand the importance, at least they don't seem to, of our communities, you know, vibrant communities to the state. I mean, Detroit is a real negative for Michigan. A lot of people, when they think of Michigan, they think of Detroit, even though we've got a lot more than Detroit.
Well, the governor says it's America's comeback city.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think so. It's certainly doing a little better than it did. You know, going through bankruptcy always, you know, helps in the short run. But they still have no tax base. You know, a few years down the road, they'll probably, unless something drastic changes, they'll still be back probably where they were. You know, we have no urban policy in this state. There are a lot of things we could do to help cities, even besides revenue sharing.
If you were advising this governor, I mean, what would you tell Rick Snyder?
One thing, for example, our research has shown that if you have a tax base of, say, less than $20,000 per person, you're going to be consistently having financial problems. So, I mean, we should have some kind of a program that would make sure that every city has the equivalent of $20,000 of tax base per capita. And we could afford it, but the only focus this administration seems to have had has been on reducing business taxes. I mean, we've reduced business taxes by, gosh, a couple billion dollars or more. We could afford to help our communities, but we're not doing it.
Robert Klein is the former treasurer of the state of Michigan and currently a partner at Great Lakes Economic Consultant. Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Still to come, one of the 19th century's most beloved writers was also great live on stage, which helped him raise money for his favorite charity.
He was quite the popular storyteller verbally and did this. And so if Dickens was giving a reading, people would come.
That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've all been shocked by what's happened in Flint. The fact that children have elevated blood lead levels because of increased lead in the water. I mean, we've just all been shocked. But we shouldn't have been. This has all happened before. In Washington, D.C., just 10 years ago, kids were exposed to lead in the water. Government officials tried to play it down. It took even longer to figure out that the kids were poisoned in Washington. And the really awful thing is, this could happen again and again, and probably is right now in other cities. That's because lead lines were used in a lot of cities. Joining us to talk a little bit about the history of lead and how we've used it is Chris Sellers. He's a professor of history at Stony Brook University. Thanks for joining us.
Why, sure.
So we've known that lead is a poison for centuries. So why in the world in the 19th and early 20th centuries would we use lead pipes to bring water into our homes?
Yeah, it's a really good question, particularly given what we know today. But part of the reason is that they didn't know nearly as much about the more subtle effects of lead as we do today. They were faced with problems in water supplies that were very much immediate and dramatic, such as typhoid and cholera. And they chose lead to build about half of the water pipes in cities that were being constructed around this time in the late 19th, early 20th century. Lead had a lot of properties that were really useful for what they wanted to do to run the pipes around corners. Lead really lasted a long time, and they did know it was poisonous, but the kinds of poisons they were looking for were very dramatic kinds of poisons.
Yeah, you mentioned in your article severe stomach aches, muscle weakness, kidney failure, seizures, or death. All a little extreme, and I guess they didn't know about the other effects at the time. So the risk of this lead poisoning was better than, as you mentioned, typhoid? That was the reasoning?
Yeah, and they were not really looking for the lead poisoning. I mean, it would show up every once in a while, and there were people who said, well, you know, our safety levels are not strict enough. But people in public health, public officials, were so worried about the infectious diseases that kind of overrode any worries about the poisonous materials they were building the water pipes out of. It's kind of extraordinary. What's also extraordinary is that it took such a long time for us to come to realize that. Part of the story is that that was kind of a minor use of this toxic metal in the early 20th century. It really took off. We used it for so many things.
Right. Just last year, I did an extensive report on lead poisoning because of older homes with lead paint. Some of the blood lead levels found in the children and living in those homes were even higher, some much higher than we've seen in Flint. So why have we struggled with eliminating the risk of exposure to lead when we know the cost is so high?
I think part of it is that there was a kind of a scientific understanding earlier in the 20th century that was built off studies done by people who were kind of in cahoots with the industry. I mean, they were even, there was not a CDC, there was not an EPA, there was not even a National Institutes of Health. And so funding for the science came largely from the industry and its allies. You had studies, for instance, the major lead investigator maintained that a certain amount of lead that now we consider to be very destructive was just normal part of modern urban life. That whole science took a while to challenge, and it took a lot of effort by as scientists became more independent, as people got funding to do studies that could challenge that hypothesis. It took a while for us to understand how bad it was. I mean, it also took successful efforts, for instance, take lead out of the gasoline.
So we now know children who are exposed to lead face a whole host of long-term problems, lower IQ, behavioral problems later in life or throughout their life. It's been suggested that taking lead out of gasoline meant, for the first time in decades, a whole generation of kids were raised without that specific lead exposure, and that might have contributed to the drop in the crime rate we've seen over the last couple of decades. Has that been verified?
Well, there have been some suggestive studies that a big chunk of that drop in crime rate is from lead exposure. I'm not sure that the evidence is that definitive. There are all sorts of other factors that are sometimes not figured in into the studies that actually looking for the lead's effect. So that's a complex phenomenon that I think we're still trying to get our heads around. But certainly there is a lot of suggestive evidence that getting rid of the lead, at least to the extent that we did so in gasoline, that it really helped. That's one of the best outcomes of getting rid of lead in gasoline. But the problem, here's the problem, though, is when you get rid of lead in gasoline, that was an exposure that just all Americans faced. It was even found in the Greenland ice caps. It was the whole world that faced the consequences of that. When you're talking about the lead in paint in old houses, when you're talking about lead in water pipes, those are more confined to particular communities. And oftentimes, those communities are not so well off. And so what we've seen is a kind of a segregation of lead's poisonous effects. You know, the overall effects have been great from getting it out of lead in gasoline, but we still have a great deal of work to do in the homes and in our built-in infrastructure to get lead out of American life and to stop the harm that has been causing ever since our binge on lead in the middle of the 20th century.
The reason lead showed up in the Flint water supply is because a chemical agent which could have prevented the corrosion and lead leaching was not added to the water. Instead of replacing the lead pipes, the chemical additive has been the cheaper option. It doesn't seem so cheap right now. How often is this the approach in the nation's cities? Rather than replace lead pipes, just use the chemical additive.
This has often been the approach that we've taken. I mean, it's certainly much cheaper than replacing the pipes. And the thing is, it's vulnerable. It's vulnerable to so many things. You have to monitor constantly and well, which often doesn't happen. You have to make sure that your bureaucrats and politicians are not short-sighted enough to say, hey, we can do without it. I mean, what happened in the Washington crisis was that they didn't put the anti-leaching agents in to begin with, but then they added something else that they thought was going to take care of the bacteria in the water called chloramines. And that is actually what caused lead to leach out even further. And from what I understand, they hadn't really even asked that question about whether that would have that kind of effects on lead. So people were kind of surprised then. If we're going to do that, we certainly need to do better monitoring of the chemicals, the additives that we put in there, and as well as the additives or whatever it is in that Flint River water, the corrosive element that has been responsible for leaching the lead out of those water pipes. You know, ultimately, though, given all the uncertainties that we've seen, we're going to have crisis after crisis until we actually have a program nationwide that can get rid of lead in drinking water pipes. It seems to me that's pretty clear. The Flint controversy is the first time we've had real proof that the lead in the water is actually bringing up kids' lead levels in the middle of the crisis. The smoking gun is there with Flint, and I think we've reached a turning point with what we found out just through the suffering of those people that hopefully will give rise to a larger push to really look at our poisonous infrastructure that's bringing the water into our faucets.
Chris Sellers is professor of history at Stony Brook University. You can read his article, Piping as Poison, The Flint Water Crisis and America's Toxic Infrastructure, online at theconversation.com. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the founding of London's Great Ormond Street Hospital, one of the world's leading children's hospital. Gifts to this hospital to support it include the unique right to royalties from stage performances of Peter Pan and any adaptation of that play. That means publications, books, ebooks, radio broadcasts, films about the story of Peter Pan in perpetuity. But the author of Peter Pan, J.M. Barrie, was not the first author to drum up donations for the hospital. Joining me now is University of Michigan medical historian and PBS NewsHour contributor Dr. Howard Markell. So take us back. Who else has been involved in raising money for the Children's Hospital?
Well, would you believe it was Charles Dickens?
I would, because I read your article. That's the only way I would know. So why was Charles Dickens attracted to this particular charity?
Well, there was many reasons. So it's 1852, and it's on this date that it was opened. Charles Dickens was fascinated with medicine and disease and public health. In fact, he often made long hikes around London, in fact, every morning, and often walked into hospitals to see how sick people acted. And he would work this into his novels. And in fact, unlike a lot of Victorian writers who, you know, somebody has to die, so they invent some symptoms and that person, you know, exits off the stage.
Because of vapors. Yeah.
Exactly. Dickens actually was describing frequently real diseases, but he was also very interested in public health, the conditions of the poor, and he loved children. And of course, his novels are filled with all kinds of children.
That's right. I mean, you know, they're usually suffering through life. So why was that a recurring theme of his books and short stories?
Well, this is one of the haunting moments of Charles Dickens' life. You know, his father, John Dickens, is the basis for Mr. Micawber. And when Charles was 12, his father was insolvent. He could not pay his bills. And so the whole family went to debtor's prison, which is described nicely, by the way, in Little Dorrit. And Charles, as a 12-year-old, was forced out of school and had to work at Warren's Blacking Factory. This was a shoe polish factory off the Strand. And it was rat-infested, and it was awful, and it was just such a horrific, traumatic experience that Charles Dickens relived and relived this the rest of his life, and in fact disguised it in his book, David Copperfield.
So he really did write what he knew.
He did, and he could totally identify with all these poor children who were just, you know, being forced into labor and factories, who were dying before their time and so on. So he had a real feeling for them.
Just how influential was Charles Dickens and his efforts to raise money for the Great Ormond Street Hospital?
He was absolutely instrumental. To begin with, Charles Dickens was the great superstar of his era. So my children are teasing me about Star Wars and how important it is. Charles Dickens was all that and more on both sides of the Atlantic. And he visited the Great Ormond Street Hospital about a day or two after it opened. And then he conducted a magazine. He edited a magazine too, actually. And he wrote about the hospital, and that article became so popular that they distributed it even further to other people, and he helped raise quite a bit of money in the early days of the hospital. And then about 6 years later, he was asked to give a grand benefit, to give a speech and to read on behalf of the hospital.
I wanted to ask you about that, because apparently he was a gifted speaker as well as a writer. You noted, as well as delivering a rousing speech on the plight of ill children, he also threw in a reading of A Christmas Carol. How did that go over?
Oh, he was the best, I'm told. I wasn't there. He was a consummate actor, and he often went on public readings both in England and in the United States. He made quite a bit of money off of it. And he was so vibrant an actor that when he reenacted the scene of Nancy's murder from the end of Oliver Twist, his blood pressure would rise precipitously, and he would actually faint because he got so involved in the scene between Oliver Sykes and Nancy. So he was quite the popular storyteller verbally and did this. And so if Dickens was giving a reading, people would come.
You wrote that when Dickens died in 1870, the British Medical Journal wrote about him. What did they have to say about him?
Well, they said, What a gain it would have been to physic, which is the old term for medicine, if one so keen to observe and facile to describe had devoted his powers to the medical art.
That'd be a big loss for us, though, right?
I say bah humbug to that. There's lots of doctors. I'm one of them, but there's only one Charles Dickens.
Dr. Howard Markell is University of Michigan medical historian. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Michigan's Chris Bathgate has gotten national acclaim in recent years, touring the country, playing music, even being featured in one of NPR's Tiny Desk concerts. For the past 4 years, though, he's taken a little hiatus. He stepped away from performing for a while and tucked away an EP he had, until now. Chris Bathgate is touring again and is finally releasing that EP. It's called Old Factory. Michigan Radio's Emily Fox has this review.
My heart is pumping. What's my location? What was I thinking?
The opening track to Chris Bathgate's latest EP is best described as being...
That's so Bathgate. This song is classic Bathgate. Bathgate at his best.
That's Bathgate. He usually performs with a loop machine and guitar while playing a snare drum with a spare hand. His music has space and builds as layers are added. This is so Bathgate. Bathgate has been keeping his music from us for a while. Here he is in an interview I did with him at the end of 2011.
I actually just finished an EP called Old Factory. It's 5 songs that are all about triggered memories. Memories that were triggered by a scent or by something that I saw or something that I heard. So memories that were triggered by my senses. Musically, it's kind of scattered as the memories are. And it's going to come out on a bar of soap.
The EP wasn't released on a bar of soap. It wasn't released until today. A few months after that interview, he canceled tour dates and declared a hiatus. Here he is on Stateside back in 2014 after he started performing again.
There was a few shows that I played where I felt like I wasn't having a good time, to be really frank. And that's a really dangerous territory when you're sharing your art, but you're doing so and it's not satisfying for you, or there's something that's lacking. In a way, it feels dishonest. So I was sort of like, you know, I'm having these feelings. I think now is the time for me to just take a step back, take a break.
He's back in the game now, finally releasing that EP and touring again.
I think the perspectives that I got from that hiatus are responsible for the sort of outpouring of art that I've experienced since then, and sort of re-energized my love for performing. I think it was necessary, and I think the quality of art that's coming forth now is directly related to that break.
This album is inspired both by memories and by nature. One of the tracks is called Red Arrow Highway, inspired by a drive Bathgate had on that scenic drive near Southern Lake Michigan shore.
On the Red Arrow Highway.
I was driving with someone that I cared about deeply, who was asleep, fast asleep. And there had been a terrible ice storm, and all the trees had a shell, a translucent shell, as they'd get in ice storms. And it was spectacular. It was like driving through this amazing forest of sort of jeweled oaks and birches and things like that. And I was just really struck in that moment, both by the external situation, the beauty of the landscape, and by this other feeling that I was experiencing in the car.
Sleeping so sad.
The single off the EP is called Calvary.
Ain't it good to be alive?
Like most of Bathgate's music, the lyrics are cryptic and descriptive.
This song is kind of a little bit of a riddle. The chorus is meant to be both earnest and cynical. And I wanted that sense of triumph from that opening line.
Ain't it good to be alive?
I think the order is really important. To follow that with the wound still in your side, it suggests something that has been overcome. So it's joyous and triumphant, but with that second line, it's not quite without struggle.
And that kind of represents Bathgate's approach to the EP itself.
Old Factory, more than any other album, is the most poignant artifact of my life because it marks this huge shift in my ideology and the way that I thought about music and the way that I thought about performing or about music persona. And coming back to it, I learned more in that period of time than I ever have in my entire life. It is a huge punctuation on this long, winding journey of lessons. It sums up all of those experiences in 5 tracks.
After more than 4 years of being tucked away, Chris Bathgate's EP Old Factory has been reawakened and is being released today. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
Coming up next, we'll talk with Enbridge about the Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today is the last day to submit testimony to the Michigan Attorney General's office regarding Line 5. That's the oil pipeline that crosses the Straits of Mackinac, the waterway connecting Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. That pipeline is 63 years old. It's owned and operated by Enbridge, a Canadian company. You might recall, Enbridge is the company that owns the pipeline that spilled more than 800,000 gallons of crude oil into the Kalamazoo River, the nation's largest inland oil spill to date. Michigan Radio's Mark Brush has visited the pipeline at the Straits of Mackinac. He's obtained video of inspections inside the pipeline, gotten government documents about it through the Freedom of Information Act, and published all of that information on Michigan Radio's website. So let's start with the basics. If Line 5 began leaking, I've seen projections that show oil polluting large areas of both Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. How safe is that line?
Yeah, that is the million-dollar question. We don't really know.
Tens of millions.
Tens of millions, right. So, I mean, we really rely on the company here for that kind of information. And the company, when you ask them, will tell you it is safe.
Well, we've been asking for some documents for some time, some raw data rather than just summaries. And you've got an expanded summary a while ago. I guess you've been busy with other things.
Yeah, there's the Flint water story that's been happening, but yeah.
But you've taken a preliminary look at what this Enbridge report says that we've been asking for more than a half year.
Yeah. So about a year and a half ago, I was out there, and the company's more than willing to, you know, show you the straits, show you their divers down underwater working on anchoring that pipeline. But at that point, a year and a half ago, they stopped short of sharing their inline inspection tool data. These are the tools that run through the pipeline. Think of your bank where you put that pneumatic tube in and you get your money back. It's like that.
Except with TV cameras and so forth, right?
Yeah, with high-tech stuff, and it tells them what the condition of that pipeline is. When I asked for that information, they stopped short. And when I asked the federal government for that data, they also said they just didn't have it. So we continually ask Enbridge, when are they going to tell us what these tools show? They finally did release this summary report of what those tools show, and I just printed it out today. They said they released it late last year. One of the things, and just a preliminary read of this, says there is a part, the deepest corroded area, so the pipelines, think about the pipelines, they're almost an inch thick, 0.8 inches thick. They found one area where 26% of that pipeline had been corroded.
26%?
Yeah.
More than a quarter of the pipe has been corroded away.
At least in this report that I'm reading here, in a 7.3-inch long section of the pipeline.
Is that allowed under federal guidelines?
They say it's well within the safety limit for this pipeline that doesn't require repair at that length. So you may ask the company about that.
I definitely will. 26% of the pipeline wall has been corroded away, and they don't have to fix that. It's still within the limits. Okay.
Right. One area of the pipeline. They say that, you know, the tool ran through both sections of pipeline.
Because there are actually two pipelines,
right,
of Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac.
Exactly. And they found 9 what they call metal loss corrosion features, and one of them here, the deepest, was 26%.
The Attorney General has been suggesting the use of Line 5 ought to end at some time. Enbridge insists it's well-maintained and safe and apparently still within federal guidelines. Environmentalists are really skeptical because the cost could mean a lot. What do we still need to know to have some reassurance that this is safe, or is there no reassurance that people will accept and we just need to find a different way to transport that oil?
Yeah, I think times have changed. I think we don't like the idea of oil going through this area of the Great Lakes. One expert I talked to said, you know, this is beyond a high-risk area. This is one of the crown jewels of Michigan. Public sentiment certainly, you know, Schutte has said this pipeline would never be allowed to be built today.
Attorney General Schutte.
Yeah, I agree with him. I think back in the 1950s, it was a different time. The question is, the company says the pipeline is safe now. Is it really safe? We have to trust them, but we need independent verification of that, and that's one thing people are calling for.
Mark Bresch leads the online news team for Michigan Radio and covered environmental issues for the Environment Report for more than a decade. Thanks for coming in and explaining this to us.
You're welcome.
Joining us now is Jason Mansham, who's a spokesperson for Enbridge Incorporated. I don't think it would overstate it to say a lot of people in Michigan are really worried they're going to see a pipeline break and oil spill like happened in 2010 near the Kalamazoo River, except this time it will be directly into Lakes Michigan and Huron. What have you found regarding corrosion problems with Line 5?
When you look at the energy infrastructure in the state, you know, Enbridge has four crude oil pipelines. And, of course, the one near the Kalamazoo River that ruptured in 2010 is one of those four. And, of course, now we're talking about a pipeline that crosses the Straits of Mackinac that delivers light crude oil and natural gas liquids to and through the state. But on all of these pipelines in the state of Michigan, it's important to know how you operate, maintain, and monitor those lines on a 24/7 basis. And Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac is no different. In fact, that particular pipeline is the most monitored and inspected line in our entire North American system because of where it is. And so when you look at how we inspect it, you know, we do it from the inside out, meaning, you know, we have tools that run on the inside of the pipe that take thousands of computer images using the latest MRI-like technology. And they're looking for things like cracks, dents, buckles, and corrosion. And then on the outside of the pipe, we do that through a team of professional divers and underwater vehicles.
Well, let's talk about some of that monitoring, because Michigan Radio's Mark Bresch just explained to us that Enbridge found 9 corrosion points. The worst one had reduced the pipeline wall by 26%. Now, these are your numbers. That sounds like a real concern. Will you be repairing that?
Yeah, so what Mark was referring to is the results of our inspection data. You know, we have heard many people across the state ask to see what the data looks like. And so late last year, we began issuing some of that inspection data on our website, which is just enbridge.com/line5. And that's what Mark has seen. And so when you look at the twin lines that cross the Straits of Mackinac, they're 220-inch diameter lines. You will see on one of those lines, some areas that you mentioned that we are monitoring. Now, that said, none of those areas, the 9 areas, hit the threshold to do a repair or replacement. The criteria there is not at that point.
If eating a quarter of the way through the wall is not the point, what is the point that you have to repair it?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know what that actual criteria number is myself personally. I'm not sure.
Well, I do. It's 51%, but it seems that's ludicrous. It's a federal regulation, I realize. But if it's at 26% eaten through the pipe, why wouldn't you fix that?
You have to look at the entire health or fitness of the line. And when you look at where some of those areas are that may come up on an indicator, on a tool, what you end up doing is you monitor that with every tool run to see if over time there's any sort of a change. And what you end up doing is you lay data on top of data to see if it's changing. And if so, you know, to what degree it might be changing. And with those areas, there actually isn't any changes happening, meaning it's staying virtually the same as it is now.
So you've known that it's been corroded by about 26% for some time.
I don't know how far back that particular data goes, not being in operations. But again, you know, what you're doing is you're basically laying new data on top of old to make any comparisons.
I understand that you're looking for changes. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if this has been changing or whether this has been like this for a long time.
You know, I don't know how long those particular indicators have been there.
These pipelines were to be tested at 1,700 PSI and operated at 600 pounds per square inch. Your company says they operate at about 150 to 200 pounds per square inch. Why so little? I mean, you make your money by getting as much oil through these pipelines as possible, and yet you've got this reduced pounds per square inch. Are you worried about something, like pressure is too great for the pipes at their age?
No. What you don't want to do is confuse operating pressure with capacity. So Line 5's capacity, the volume in which it can move, is up to 540,000 barrels a day. And we are currently operating at or near capacity on a day-to-day basis. But we can operate at that full capacity with a very low operating pressure. So you're right, when you test it, you always test the pipeline at a much higher rate, pounds per square inch, than you will ever operate it. And so it was tested at 1,700 pounds per square inch. The maximum allowable limit that we could operate it is 1,200 pounds per square inch. On a day-to-day basis, Line 5 in its entirety is generally between 0 and 300 pounds per square inch. But you're right, at the Straits of Mackinac, averaging right around 100 PSI, significantly less. And part of that reason is the nature of the design. That's why you have two twin lines there. It's just one more way you can help ensure the longevity and the fitness for service over time. But that doesn't mean there's any indicator that there's an issue there. It's just another safety measure.
It appears Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette has taken up the very future of Line 5. As he puts it, Line 5's days are numbered. What has been Enbridge's response or reaction to the AG's request for experts to analyze Line 5?
You know, we've been working with the state-appointed task force since its inception a couple of years ago. And as you know, last summer, when the task force issued their 14 recommendations, four of them were specific to Line 5. And out of that came an advisory board. And the advisory board, of course, is represented by members of various entities and industries. And Enbridge is one of those entities on that advisory board. And what the board is doing right now is taking those recommendations and vetting them through. So at the end of this process, the task force will have the next steps that they can present to the governor. And so what the advisory board is looking at right now are the recommendations of a risk analysis and an alternatives analysis. And the alternatives analysis in particular would involve finding an independent, credible third party to review any and all alternatives to Line 5 and then come out with its findings at that point. And the recommendations could be anything from replacing the line using existing pipelines, you know, other infrastructure, using other vehicles like barge on the Great Lakes, freighter, trucks, rail, or it could be status quo, leaving everything as it is. But that's what the advisory board is looking at right now, and we're in full support of this state-led process.
So for the time being, Enbridge is keeping this 63-year-old pipeline operating in the Straits of Mackinac because it's cheaper, you don't have an obvious alternative, it keeps Enbridge competitive with other pipeline companies. You might have concerns about your stock price, I suppose, but I think the concerns of the 40 million people who get their drinking water from the Great Lakes and the people who depend on the $4 billion sports fishing industry might think their concerns take priority. So why should we put faith that Enbridge is doing all that it can, that it's waiting for reports, it's waiting for a concession, it's waiting for alternatives to be named? Why not do something now because of these greater concerns?
You know, it's the balance that you have to have between obviously protecting the natural environment, but also delivering safely and reliably the energy that we use as Michigan residents on a day-to-day.
Yeah, but most of that energy is passed through the state. We're not benefiting from it. It's going somewhere else.
Actually, on the contrary to that, the natural gas liquids that we move on that pipeline end up heating 85 out of every 100 homes in northern Michigan, including the Upper Peninsula. And then even downstate, where it exits near the St. Clair River, it goes to feed refineries in the lower portion of Michigan. In the crude oil, about 30% of everything we move exits, again, downstate near Marysville to serve directly into the Detroit area refineries, predominantly the Marathon refinery here in Michigan. And on top of that, Line 5 also picks up Michigan crude from the Kalkaska, Michigan area. It enters our system at Lewiston from another pipeline. And so we can feed Michigan crude downstate to the Detroit area and then beyond. But it plays a crucial role in the energy that we rely on each and every day. So again, it's making sure that you can safely and reliably operate that to bring us the energy that we need and do so in a way that protects people and the environment.
I'd like to see those numbers because I'd like to stand corrected on that. So if you can send those to me, that would be great. The bottom line is the pipeline is going to be in place for a while. You're looking at these different studies. I'm just wondering what kind of timeline before a decision about Line 5 is going to be made and when Enbridge plans to replace it because it can't last forever.
You're right. Pipelines, if they're properly maintained and monitored, can have extraordinarily long lives. But not all pipelines are created equal either. Some can last far longer than others. You know, Line 5 in particular was in much better shape than the original Line 6B. And that's the one that you mentioned earlier that ruptured near the Kalamazoo. Even though the Line 6B was newer by about 10 to 12 years, it wasn't maintaining its fitness for service nearly as well. It required much more maintenance. And that's one of two reasons why it was replaced, actually. But Line 5 doesn't meet any of those indicators. So to your question of a plan to replace it, as a pipeline owner and operator, of course we have a plan to eventually replace any pipeline that we operate. In fact, we have replacement projects going on in other parts of the United States as we speak. But again, how you come to that conclusion is looking at the kind of the key performance indicators for things like corrosion, which might mean thinning of the walls, cracks, buckles, any corrosion, things of that nature. And you get to a point where when you start to see these indicators get to a certain level, that's when you have to make the decision, does it require extensive repairs in these areas, or does it require complete replacement? That's the criteria that we saw on Line 6B downstate. But at this time, we're not seeing it anywhere along Line 5 at the Straits or otherwise. But again, I can't overemphasize that point that if and when that time comes, that's when you begin the plans to make a move to replace or repair.
Jason Mancham is a spokesperson for Enbridge Incorporated, which operates the oil pipeline called Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's the sound of a very special flute. You might remember this story last spring about an 80-year-old agave plant that bloomed and died in Ann Arbor. Hundreds poured into the Mathai Botanical Gardens to get a look. Well, the plant has been immortalized in a way. A piece of the dead agave stalk has been made into a flute. And now the agave flute will appear at a concert this Saturday at its old home. Michael Gould, an associate professor of music at the University of Michigan, will be performing alongside flute player Michael Chikuzen Gould, no relation. Chikuzen specializes in Japanese bamboo flutes. U of M's Michael Gould says people are still fascinated with the plant that exceeded its life expectancy by about 50 years.
And I think it just captures people's imaginations that 80 years ago this plant was planted by somebody.
The two musicians will perform three songs. Gould says one of the songs is dedicated to a much younger agave plant that is just about to blossom. That plant is 26 years old.
The tune is from the perspective of this old plant communicating with this new plant, because when an agave flowers, soon after it dies. And so this plant is just about to blossom and it's all excited and ready to go. And the old agave is telling the young one what's about to happen.
Agave plants only bloom once in their lifetime, typically between 10 and 30 years. The sold-out concert takes place Saturday night at the Mathai Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor. In the interest of full disclosure, Enbridge Incorporated is an underwriter of Michigan Radio. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.